says the chairperson is supposed to briefly qualify. I've heard that ever since I've been coming today, and nobody's explained to me what they're talking about. Do I need to qualify as an alcoholic, or do I need to qualify to stand up here and chair an AA meeting? Well, I qualify by telling you I claim to be an alcoholic. And my opinion's the only opinion that matters in that case. A lot of people have a lot of opinions about me, but I have come to the opinion that I cannot drink safely ever again. And I don't know what caused it, and a lot of people have different theories, my friends in AA included. It doesn't make any difference. I think that I have lost the ability to control my drinking. I wasn't always this way. It was progressive, and I am this way now, and I know that from my experience. I don't dare drink at all. I believe it sets something off in me that's physical as well as mental and not spiritual at all. But every time I take a drink, I want another drink. And I don't care how much I tell you beforehand what I'm going to do. Once I start drinking, it's like I have an unquenchable thirst. I take another drink. And it's a bad place to be if you got this problem. And the worst problem is a mental problem. I can't keep from doing it. And no human power can keep me from doing it. But I found a way out through AA, and God has changed me in spite of myself, and I don't want to drink today, one day at a time. And it's easy not to drink when you don't want to drink. But anyway, so that's my qualification, like it or not. When you sign up to chair the chairperson's meeting here at Central for a month, you get to pick the speakers. And so I got to pick the speakers, and I picked my friend John to speak to us. And I've known this guy a long time in AA. I've never heard him stand up and tell his story. Now, he talks all over the place, all over the world. I don't know that for a fact. But he's done this on a number of occasions. And so it's a treat for me to get him to come up here and speak for me tonight. Now, I've never seen John drinking, but he tells me how he used to be, and I believe him. And he tells me what happened to him, and I believe him. And I can see the way he is now. And it's my pleasure to give you John.
Hello, everybody. My name's John. I'm a real alcoholic. And I'm kind of like Bob. I'm sold out on the idea that I'm an alcoholic. And I'm an alcoholic of a hopeless variety. You know, Central is home for me. This is where it all started at for me. I came here to Central and just fresh out of prison, didn't know what was going on, and Lee brought me here at Central. And I heard you guys tell your stories, and you talked about how you had been something like I was, and you looked it good, and you was dressed pretty good, and some of you had automobiles, and you were homeowners, and some of you had relationships that even worked. And I said, man, I want what these guys want. And I used to hear you talk about that stuff, and I used to ask God to give me a double portion of what you had. I didn't just want what you had, I wanted a double portion of that. And it's been great just being a part of this. You know, when I first came to Alcoholic Anonymous, and before I got to Alcoholic Anonymous, my family and nobody else wanted anything to do with me. People were tired of me. And the big book of Alcoholic Anonymous talked about we would meet lifelong friends. And the night I got friends here from Flagler County, Volusia County, isn't that something? That mean a lot to me, that people don't see me the same anymore. You know, we get here in Alcoholic Anonymous and we identify with the things that people say. And Lee said something last night that just got into my head and it stuck there. Lee said he was in a meeting one time and a guy said he stopped at an AA meeting on the way to the cemetery. And I said, I agree. I can identify with that. Man, I was on the way to the cemetery when I got here. I got a friend in Las Vegas named Bob D. And this is the last time I'm going to give him credit for this story. After this, this is my story. My Bob friend talks about a rat and some scientists doing a study on these rats. And he said a scientist came up with this thing where they was going to hook some electrodes up to the pleasure center of the rat's brain, the get high spot. And they was going to do a little experiment on the rats. And they put hooked the wires up to the rat brain and put a paddle in the cage. And the rat learned if he hit that paddle that he'd get high. So the rat laid on the paddle. So they thought, well, we'll put some water in here. Maybe he'll stop and have a drink of water. And they put the water in there. The rat looked at the water and laid on the paddle. So they thought they'd put some cheese in there. And I bet it was some gourmet cheese, too. They want to try the old rat out. The rat looked at the cheese and he stayed on the paddle. So they thought they'd put Miss Rat in. And they put Miss Rat in the cage and he looked at her like she didn't even exist. And the rat laid on the paddle until he died. So they came up with this thing. They said, right before death, we'll unhook the juice. And they hooked it up to another rat and put him in there and probably went through the same routine. And right before the rat died, they cut the juice off. And the rat went over and hit the paddle and nothing happened. He went over and hit the pedal again and nothing happened. And then the rat went in a corner of the cage and balled up in a fetal position to die. And the rat probably thought this, without the juice, what's the use? I can remember that, April the 18th of 1998, laying in the Brevard County Jail. And when I heard that story, this is what I said. I said, I'm that rat. I'm that rat. Because laying in Brevard County Jail in a fetal position, I wanted the end to come. Just like the big book talk about the jumping off, being in a vision for you, being at that jump. Can't live with it, can't live without it. And I just wanted the end to come. And I was to a place where, you know, death wasn't a bad deal for a guy like me. Because I had all of me that I could stand. And I didn't want no more what I was putting out. April 18th of 1998 is my sobriety date. I'm a member of the Central Group. And when I first got out of prison, Lee used to bring me to a lot of meetings here. And this is the way Lee would introduce me to you guys. Look, meet John. He one of them bad kind of alcoholics. And you all would laugh at me like you're doing now. And I just kept on coming to meetings here. And I said, now these some bad alcoholics. I hadn't connected back with my family, and it was around Christmas time. And I told Lee, I said, well, I don't know what I'm going to do, man. It's Christmas time. He said, John, you got plenty of family down at Central. So he brought me. I had my first Christmas dinner here at Central. And he brought me here to Central, and y'all was having a meeting, and it started at 10. About 11 o'clock, I could smell the aroma from that food, and I'm thinking, is this meeting going to ever end? So around about noon, the meeting came to an end, and I got up, and I began to fix me a plate of, got me some ham and turkey and all that stuff. And I say, man, this is an upgrade in my eating. They don't feed you like this in DOC. And then when I got through fixing the plate, I asked Lee, I said, who do I pay for this? He said, John, you don't pay for this. This is for free. See, that was different for me. Where I had just came from, everything had a price tag on it. Nothing was for free. I'm an alcoholic of a hopeless variety. And the reason why I say I'm an alcoholic of a hopeless variety is because my family told me so. My friends told me so. Brevard County Sheriff Department told me so. The Department of Corrections told me so. Even the statistics was against me. The statistics say that every man that get out of prison return within the 90% return within the first year. But since I've been in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I hadn't had the obsession to commit the type of crimes that land me in prison. It's been 13 years since I had to jump a fence. You know, being an alcoholic of a hopeless variety, you have some pretty bad things to happen to you. I remember my driver's license was suspended. And I still had a car. And I lived about 6 blocks from the store. And I said, there ain't no way a police officer gonna get me before I get to the store. So I got in my car, and before I could get out the driveway good, the blue lights was on me. And I knew my brother's date of birth and social security number. So the officer came up and he said, let me see your driver's license. I told him, I don't have any. He said, well, let me see your ID. I said, I don't have that either. He said, well, what's your name and date of birth and social security number? So instantly I became Lars L. Hunter. He got my brother's date of birth, social security number, and my brother's name, and he went back to his car and he ran it through. He came and tapped back on the window. I said, yes, sir. He said, will you step out the car, Mr. Hunter? I stepped out the car, and he began to put handcuffs on me. And I asked him, I said, well, what are you doing? He said, you're $18,000 behind in child support. It take an alcoholic of a hopeless variety to have a life like that. I want to talk to y'all a little bit about my childhood and my past. And I'm not going to stand at this podium and tell you that my childhood and my past made me an alcoholic. Usually you have to drink a little whiskey to become an alcoholic. But when I got the whiskey, it sure did help me with my childhood and my past. My father was a sharecropper. My mother was a Southern Baptist. My mother taught me everything any good mother would teach her child. My mom made me go to Sunday school on Sunday mornings. She made me go to church on Sunday evenings. My mom even taught me the golden rules. She sat me down and told me, baby, if you're going to make it in this world, you're going to have to learn to do unto others as you would have them to do unto you. But something happened about the age of 9. My mom passed away. And when my mom passed away, all of that passed away. My father was a chronic alcoholic. There was times I went to bed hungry at night. There was times I went to school on a wet, cold ground with holes in the bottom of my shoes. There was times I went to school and my clothes wasn't real good and kids would make fun of me. So low self-esteem sat in instant. There were times I thought if I made it over to my older sisters and brother's house that everything would be all right. And when I would get there, they had little ugly things to say. So I felt less than and inferior to everything and everybody at a real young age. I used to try to do stuff to get the teacher's approval, and that didn't even work. I can remember being in the house, and my father come up in his car, and I could hear him blowing his car horn, and I knew my father would be out there drunk. And I always had a decision to make. Was I going to leave him out there drunk, or was I going to go out and help him and embarrass myself in front of my friends? And my decision was always this, that I was going to help my father no matter what. And I would go out to that car and get my father and start helping him in the house. And I would hear kids say, look at John. He got to drag his drunk dad in the house again. See, I felt that those kids were better than me. I never seen them drag their father in the house. There were times I used to be looking out my bedroom window. And kids would be out in the yard playing catch football or wrestling around with their fathers. And instantly I would blame God. And I would say, what kind of God would take a 9-year-old boy's mother? But standing to this podium tonight, I have to let God off the hook because God left me with a father that wasn't willing to step up to the plate. I got interested in girls. What do? When you get interested in girls, you go to those little teen centers. Man, I get to that teen center, those girls would be smelling good, looking good. I said, man, I'm going to dance with me some of these girls tonight. Man, that song would come on and go off, and I said, well, maybe the next song. And then I look out on the floor, and there's some guy out there with a pair of Chuck Taylors and Levi's. And man, that guy would have a circle of girls around. How many of y'all know about Chuck Taylors and Levi's? That's old school. And that guy would have a circle of girls around dancing, and I said, man, that's what it is. It's the Chuck Taylors and the Levi's. So I'd work and save my money up and buy me some Chuck Taylors and Levi's. And go back off to the dance. How many of y'all know I was a guy standing up against the wall with a pair of Chuck Taylors and Levi's? There was something on the inside of me that wouldn't let me respond to things on the outside of me. But my father and sister came up with a wise idea that I needed to go spend some time with my aunt and uncle in Georgia. And when I got to Statesboro, Georgia, my aunt and uncle had two boys a little bit older than me. And one Saturday night they asked me, did I want to go to the dance? And I told them, yeah. And we got in this old farm model truck and we headed off to the dance. They got about a mile down the road and there was a old house there. And they pulled up in there. We got out and knocked on the door and an elderly guy came to the door. And they asked him, would he sell us a pint of moonshine? And he went back in and came back with a pint of moonshine and an MD-2020 ball. If any of y'all know about bootlegging, you know that combination. He gave us a pint of moonshine and we got back in the truck. One of the brothers took a drink and gave it to me. I said, I don't want that. And the other brother took it and took a drink. When we got to the club, the other brother took a drink. and passed it to me. I said, I don't want it. He said, man, take a drink of this. It'll make you feel good. Man, I took me a big swallow of that moonshine. You know, I can remember it just like it was yesterday. Dr. Silkworth said, you shall remember. Guess what? I love carrot cake, but I don't remember my first slice. But I can remember that. But, you know, if moonshine had been a lot of people's first drink, they would have spit it back out their mouth. But something happened when that moonshine hit my mouth. My glands began to water. There was a warm, burning feeling went down on the inside of me. And when it hit the pits of my stomach, felt like my stomach began to expand. Felt like my head exploded. Felt like I was 10 feet tall, bulletproof, and instantly good looking. You know, I say I was shy about dancing with girls. I danced with all of them that night. I had it going on. And I could talk to people, man. You know what? That moonshine didn't do nothing to me. It did something for me. And for many, many years, whiskey was my answer. That was different when something do something to you and for you. Guess what? That liquor brought me from a place I had never been from before. And for many, many years, alcohol was my answer. And then my answer turned on me. And I didn't get another answer until I made it here to you guys. I can remember getting back home that summer, and my friends had been doing a little drinking too. And we'd get together and put our money together in the morning time, and we'd buy alcohol and some other little things. Now, I may say something about drugs a time or two here in my talk. And it's not because I belong in Narcotic Anonymous. I'm an alcoholic, and I'm at home. If you put a pile of crack on this podium in front of me tonight, I'll call the police on you. You give me a drink of whiskey, and I'll kill you about that pile of crack. When I drink alcohol, I become open to everything else. Crack was just another way my alcoholism showed up. And, man, some days we wouldn't have money to buy anything with. And I used to wear a leather jacket. And I'd go in 7-Eleven and put three fills of MD-2020 in the back of that leather jacket. And you'll never know it. Right away, I began to steal for alcohol. And sometimes we'd be riding late at night, and they said, John, we got to go to school tomorrow, man. We got to go home. And I tell them to drop me off, and I continue to drink. How many of y'all know you can't stay in school long drinking MD-2020? It just don't happen. My sister and father again told me that I needed an education, so they got me in Job Corps. I went to Job Corps. I'd done good for about 2 weeks. And they let me go on a Liberty trip. And a guy on that bus told me, said, John, this bus will ride a half a gallon of liquor. And I told him, quit playing. He said, you know I don't play. When we got to Knoxville, Tennessee, we got a half a gallon of Bacardi rum. There was a tie flipped up under that bus. We put that half a gallon of rum there. And when we got back on the Job Corps Center, that rum was there. After a couple of trips like that, you can't stay in Job Corp drinking rum. They had to run me out of Job Corp. On my way home, I made my mind up that I was going to live the way I wanted to live. See, I wasn't afraid of my father anymore. I wasn't afraid of my sisters and brothers anymore. Alcohol had gave me all the courage I needed. And I felt like I was ready for the world. When I got back home, I began to hang out with the drug dealers. I began to sell a little drugs. I was able to buy a few toys. I was able to dress nice. Most of all, I was able to drink the way I wanted to drink. Tom Collie, Scotch, Hennessy, Valentine. My story is different from a lot of people's stories. A lot of people say alcohol quit working for them. That ain't my story. My last drink was just like my first one. Alcohol did what it was supposed to do. I just got tired of the consequences. Somewhere in life, I crossed an invisible line. A place of no return. The police began to get mad with me. They began to put me in jail for periods of time. They would put me in jail, and I'd stay in jail for about 30 days. And my head would clear up. And I say to myself, when I get out of jail, I always had a plan. When I get out of jail, it's going to be different. I'm going to get me a job. I'm going to go back to school and try to get me some type of education. I'm going to do the right thing when I get out of here, because I ain't coming back here no more. And they let me out of jail. And I get just about a mile to that bus stop. And the disease of alcoholism will begin to speak to me. And it always sounded something like this. It's been a long time since you had a beer. One won't hurt. There were times they put me in prison for periods of time. And I'd write my family and tell them I found religion. I walk after the things of God. I'm a saved man. When I get out, it's going to be different this time. And my family would believe me. I believed me. And if they had gave me a lie detector test, I would have passed it because I meant business. I wasn't doing the things I had done no more. But the only thing they done when they let me out of prison, they let me out of prison. And sometimes it would be a couple of weeks before my family would see me. And when my family would see me, they say, you know what, you the biggest liar we know. What my family didn't understand, I was doing the best that the disease of alcoholism would allow me to do.
Thirsty.
There was times I'd be on the street corner, and my appearance had begun to fail. And my family would come on the street corners, and they would say, please, just come go home with us. If it ain't but for one day, come go home with us. Come get you some rest. And I'd look in that car, and I could see all that shame and pain in their faces. And I'd say to myself, I'm going to stop hurting them like this. I ain't hurting them like this no more. I'd make my mind up right then that I wasn't going to hurt them like that anymore. And I'd get in that car, man, and they'd stop and buy me some clothes to put on and take me to their home, allow me to have a warm shower, give me clean clothes to put on, a clean bed to sleep in. And I'd walk through and look at them, and I'd say, man, I ain't hurting them like this no more. And I sit there about 2 or 3 days, and I begin to get irritable and discontent, and my mind would begin to scream. Somebody here know what I'm talking about. My mind would begin to scream, and I know if I got me a drink of alcohol, I could quieten that thing down. And I would leave that house with the mindset of going to the corner store to have one tall boy to quieten that down. And I'd be off and running. Remember, I said, that's the family that I love. That's the family that I swore I wasn't going to hurt anymore. But I couldn't stop drinking. I met a woman in Melbourne, and she said, you know, it's Melbourne got you drinking the drug in the way you're doing. We ought to move to Atlanta. And she called her mother. And her mother got us an apartment. Her mother got her a job. Her stepfather got me a job. And we was off to Atlanta. I did good for about 2 weeks. How many of y'all know they sell whiskey in Atlanta too? Yeah. See, you can't outrun this thing. That geographic cure don't work. Trust me. I tried it. And man, I messed up everything those people tried to do for me. I was working at a store in Atlanta called Video Ingram. And there was a guy working with me, and he had a toy poodle. And the toy poodle was bad about chewing electrical cords. He said, John, I have to keep everything in the house unplugged. One night he went to bed and forgot to unplug the electric lamp. And that dog got hold of that lamp cord. And he said, you can hear him holler all over the house. I said, yeah. He said, John, now when I go home, I pick that cord up and wave at him. I said, what do we do? He said, man, that dog holler all over again. See, that dog had more sense than me. That dog didn't want no more of the thing that was hurting him. Guess what? He never had the obsession to chew another electrical cord. But you take me. Alcohol could beat me up one side, tear me down the other side, cause me to lose the best relationship I ever had, put more space between me and my family than there ever been, put me in jail deeper than I ever been. And the day they let me out, you wave a ball at me, I'll do it all over again. The big book of Alcoholic Anonymous said that our dilemma is a lack of power. I have no defense against the first drink. I can remember getting to the end. My sister came on the street corner with an insurance policy. And she told me, she said, I need you to sign this insurance policy. I heard about the things you were doing, and I'm going to need something to bury you with. With tears in her eyes, and I signed that policy. She heard about I had been snatching people jewelry when they come up to buy drugs. And the drug dealers used to say, man, give him something to get him off the corner. He bad for business. You know, you're in a world of trouble when drug dealers don't want you around. I can remember walking late at night feeling all the guilt, the shame, and the pain. And sometimes, and I began to say a prayer, God, if I'm going to ever change, you're going to have to help me change. I can't do this. And by 3 weeks of praying that prayer, my family house was surrounded by Brevard County Sheriff's Department. And that morning I met a powerful greater than myself. And they came in there and they got me and they hauled me off. And when they was bringing me out, my family and neighbors was in the yard. And I looked back in my family face and I could see all that shame and pain once again. And out the back of that window, I was trying to tell them that I love them. See, I thought that April the 18th of 1998 was the end for me. I did not know that it was the beginning of a brand new life. When I got to jail, I stayed in jail about 30 days and then a public defender came and seen me. And the public defender And when I sat down, he said, Mr. Hunter, they got you to the right this time. This is what they're asking for. They're asking for 30 years on each charge. They want to run them consecutive. What they're asking for is 60 years. And the public defender got up and started walking away, and I said, well, what are you doing? Come here. And he looked at me just like, man, there ain't nothing I can do to help you. And about 60 days later, they took me into court. I was in the holding cell. And the public defender and the state attorney came through the door at the same time. And I looked in, I'm thinking, what is this public defender doing? Is he butting up with the state attorney? When they got to the holding cell, the state attorney bent over to the chute. And he said, Mr. Hunter, I got you to the right this time. If you plea out the 30 years, I'll run the other 30 years concurrent. And he got up and walked away. And then the public defender bent over to the chute and say, Mr. Hunter, I think it's a good deal. You ought to take it. Oh, and I bent over to the chute and told him, you take it. So they took me into court, and the judge said, Mr. Hunter, how do you plead? And I said, Your Honor, I plead to the mercy of the court. And the state attorney said, Your Honor, hold up a minute. And he pulled up a television set, and he put a video in, and it was just like you guys looking at me. And the judge said, Mr. Hunter, with your prior record, and this video, I'll probably go along with the state. And I said, Your Honor, if I get this type of time today, you're going to have to give it to me. I won't accept it from the state. He hit the table. Bam, get him out of here, recess. During the recess period, I got down on my knees and I asked God, God, if I get 30 or 60 years today, let it be your will and not theirs. About an hour went by, they took me back in front of the court. And the judge told my public defender to approach the bench with the habitual papers. He did. He told a state attorney, approach my bench with the habitual papers. He did. And the judge was flipping through his folder. And he said, I can't find them. And my public defender said, Your Honor, would you say that a little clearer for the record? He said, I can't find them. But I'm fixing to give Mr. Hunter every day I can give him by law. And by law, all he could give me was 5 years in the Department of Correction, followed by 4 years probation. See, there's not a second guess in my mind why I'm here at the Central Group tonight. I'm here at the Central Group tonight because the loving God looked down upon me and showed grace and mercy. I told y'all about the video. If they'd have gave me what I deserved, you'd have a different speaker here tonight. They took me to prison. When I first got to prison, I used to walk around the recreational yard, and I prayed this prayer for 4 years and 3 months that I was in prison. I used to look up at that wire, and I said, God, you didn't make me to be caged up like a wild animal. And I'm not asking you to get me out of here because I'm guilty of what they say I did. What I'm asking you is when I get out of here, that you help me be a blessing to my family, not a hindrance. I was in prison for a while, and I was forced into a tier program. And when I went into the tier program, I was challenged by a counselor to read a book. And he gave me that book, and I took it back on the compound. And I was reading in the book, and I read about anywhere from 3 to 4 pages in the book asked me a question. It asked me, had I ever been defeated by alcohol? And I can remember the times that I used to have my rent money. And I had with everything in me, I was going to pay my rent the next morning. But the night before, I would drink that rent money up and get evicted. I can remember the times when I used to like to fish. But due to drugs and alcohol, I didn't own a rental rod or any tackle anymore. I can remember the times I was living with a woman in an apartment, and I had to find a notice on the light bill. And with everything in me, I was going to pay that light bill the next morning. But that drink thing hit me in the midst of the night. And I just wanted one to take the edges off. Y'all know the rest of the story. The woman and the little children had to live with me on the candlelight. And when I went back, the counselor asked me, he said, John, what's wrong? I told him that alcohol became my master, and I was its slave. Shortly after that, I was transferred to Tomoka, and I stayed there for a couple of weeks. And upon release, I went to the recovery house in Central Florida. And when I got to the recovery house in Central Florida, I called my family, and they say, we thought you was getting out today. And I said, I'm out. And they said, well, where are you? I told them I signed myself up in a halfway house for another year. And they say, what? You the biggest fool we know. You just did 4 years and 3 months in prison, and you're going to lock yourself up for another year? But see, my family couldn't see my fear. It had been since the age of 14. I'd been sober in society, and I wanted to win this time. at all costs. I didn't care if I had to stay in the recovery house 2 years. I wanted to win. And every Thursday night, a guy used to bring a big book study into the recovery house. And one Thursday night, instead of doing that big book study, he told his story. And when he told his story, I heard my story. And after he got through, I asked him, will you show me how to stay sober? And he told me, I'll show you what they showed me. Me and him sat down and we talked about steps 1, 2, and 3. We got to page 98 of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, the second paragraph. It stated, we must burn this idea into the conscience of every man, that he could get sober in spite of anyone under these conditions, that he trusts God and he clean house. He said, John, I see that you trust God. Now it's time for you to clean house. Lee took me across the street and bought me a notebook, tablet, and an ink pen. We came back to the recovery house. We sat down. He drew some lines on the paper. And he said, John, I want you to write in this first row right here the name of all the people you hate, the resentment list. I said, man, this is going to be easy. Don't you know I remember? And the second week he came back, he said, I want you to tell me why you hate them, the cause. I said, man, don't you know I remember what they done to me? But the third week he came back, he flipped the script on me. He told me he want me to pray for him. I said, what? He said, yeah, John, I want you to pray for him. And you better mean business. He said, if you want to get sober, you better mean business. I said, okay, I'll pray for him. I prayed that the kids were college graduates. I asked God to give them the income they needed to support their families. And some of them I couldn't pray for. And I told him, God, if you want me to love this one, then you got to love him through me so that the love can be made perfect. About a few more weeks, he came back and he asked me how that prayer been going. I told him, it's been going all right, but two people. And he said, John, who is the two people? I said, my father who treated me so poorly as a child, and my sister-in-law who shot me in the back with a hunting rifle and caused me to lose my right lung. And I swore if I lived, I'd get even with her. And he told me, he said, John, sit down. And I sat down, and he said, John, think about three of the worst things you ever did. I thought about three of the worst things I've done. And he said, John, do you think you should be forgiven? I said, yes, I think I should be forgiven. He said, John, I think you should be forgiven too. He said, the reason why you did what you did were because you were spiritually sick. The reason why your father and that girl did what they did to you were because they were spiritually sick. That was good news that my father was spiritually sick. That meant that my father wasn't the type of man that would send me out on a wet, cold ground with holes in the bottom of my shoes. That meant that my father wasn't the type of man that would send me to bed hungry at night. That meant that my father wasn't the type of man that would abandon me in the midst of a crisis. That meant that my father was caught in the grip of alcoholism, and no human power could have relieved him of that. You know, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous said that resentment is our number one offender. We must rid ourselves of resentment or it kills us. A resentment for me is like this. It's like me filling this bottle up with poison and drinking it and waiting for you all to die. All those years I was dying on the inside and nobody knew it but me. You know, I listen to a lot of R&B, and there's an R&B singer named Betty Wright. And she sings a song called No Pain, No Gain. And she say, if you can receive the gift to forgive, a longer and a better life you'll live. No pain, no gain. So wait a minute. I was listening to her. I said, wait a minute. That sounds like AA talk. So I had to make sure that's what she was saying. And sure enough, she say, if you can receive the gift to forgive, a longer and a better life you'll live. And I'm saying, do you mean when I forgive somebody else that I get set free? See, when we hate a person, that's taking. When we pray for a person, that's giving. I've never seen a person give spiritually and not receive. Now, this is where she got me the most at. She said, if you can receive, you mean forgiveness don't come from me? No, forgiveness don't come from me. Forgiveness comes from God through me when I become an open vessel. When I become willing to set you free, God help me set you free. And if it comes through me, guess what? I get to keep a little of that. Where else do we get a deal like this at? I remember doing my fifth step, and I told my sponsor everything in my fifth step. I didn't know if he was going to call the police or not, but I still didn't want to get drunk no more. And he asked me, he said, John, are you ready to have... Yeah, there's some newcomers in here. And if anybody ever tell you, if you put a half in, you can get half out, that's the biggest lie I ever heard in Alcoholics Anonymous. If you put half in, you don't get nothing out. This is an all or nothing deal. Half measures avail us nothing. If you want what we got, then you got to do what we did. And I remember Lee asking me, he said, John, are you ready to have God remove your shortcomings? And I said, yeah. He said, what are they? I said, huh? But him being the fine sponsor that he was, he would say, he told me, John, you're a deadbeat dad, you're a liar, you're a thief. And there were some other things he said. But he told me, he set me free. He pointed at me and told me he believed that the dirtiest, rottenest thing I ever did, I did it to survive, based upon the circumstances I was caught up in. And if I would give that stuff to God, God would set me free. Now, everybody else had told me a little different. They told me I needed to burn in hell for it, and some of them tried to send me there. But he told me that God would set me free if I did that. Now, I'm going to tell you something. When you first come to Alcoholics Anonymous, now, your character defects, that's your character. That's all you got. Now, if you give up your character defects, that's going to leave a void place. What are you going to fill that void place with? One of my mentors told me this. He said, John, write down what you would have God to be. And I said, I want a loving God, a kind God, an understanding God, and a caring God. And he said, now, practice the characteristics of your higher power. He said, that's your conception of God. And nobody can take that away from you. But practice that. And when I practice that, feel like I'm floating through the universe. Now, don't get any ideas in your head that your character defects are gone for good. They got a way of popping their ugly heads up. One time there was a preacher, the little boy named Johnny. Johnny was good by fixing things. Johnny found the lawnmower, painted it red, fixed it up. That Sunday morning, no Southern Baptist preacher coming through there. He said, Johnny had a sign on the lawnmower, $20. The preacher said, Johnny, how come you want so much for that lawnmower? He said, that's just the price of it, Rail. He said, do it run, Johnny. He said, yeah, it run. So the preacher went over there and began to jerk the string. He couldn't get it crank. He looked at Johnny and said, Johnny, I thought you said this thing will crank. He said, it will, but there's a trick to it. He said, what's the trick? He said, you got to kick it, spin on it, and curse it. Preacher said, Johnny, it's been so long since I cursed, I doubt if I can even curse. And plus, I'm a preacher. Johnny told him, you jerk that string a few more times, it'll all come back. Now, see, that's the same way it is with our character defense. If you think they don't, let somebody jerk your string hard enough. I remember sitting down and start writing my 8-step list. And I was writing on my 8-step list. And Lee asked me, what are you doing? I said, I'm writing my 8-step list. He said, do you remember when I asked you, was you selfish, dishonest, and inconsiderate toward any of those people in your 4-step? I said, yeah. He said, now that's your 8-step list, but you can add to it. Now, if I knew he was going to use that as part of my 8-step list, I wouldn't have been selfish, dishonest, and inconsiderate toward some of those people. Because I didn't feel like I owed my daughter's mother anything. She took my parents to rights for 9 years. And that was the first amend he made me start on. I said, man, I don't want to do this amend. This amend is going to open up a can of worms. It's going to cause a lot of problems for me. And anyway, my daughter probably won't even never get a chance to read the letter. He said, John, write the letter. I wrote the letter and I brought it back. I said, man, don't make me mail this letter. This is going to cause a lot of problems. And he said, John, let's pray over the letter. We prayed over the letter and mailed the letter. Within a week time, I got a phone call. And it was my daughter. And she told me that she wanted me to be a part of her life. And that she wanted to build a relationship with me. Where else can we get that, man? If we don't do the work here, how can we get these things? She's expensive, but she's back. I was in Melbourne. I went to Melbourne years after I'd done my amend list and all that stuff. And I'm thinking I'm through with making amends. So I'm riding through Melbourne, and I get to this little convenience store. And it popped me in the head, you owe that guy an amend. I used to go in there and steal wine. And the guy used to catch me sometimes, and I would try to fight with him, so the guy barred me off his property. I said, I can't go make that amend. I'm barred off this property. I got about a couple of more blocks, and it became the strongest thing on my mind. I just turned my car around. See, I'm going to take a chance. I went back and pulled in front of the store. I opened the door to the store. The guy pointed at me and said, "You're a different man." And then he said it again with a smile on his face. "You're a different man." And I told him, I said, "I've done you wrong and I'm here to make it right." And he said, "Oh, don't worry about it." And I explained to him that I was in a fellowship. And one of the requirements was that I clean up the record from my past. And he pointed at me again and he said, "If you made it right with God, you've already made it right with me." What a deal we get here. Where else do we get a deal like this? I do step 10. Every evening I'm on step 10. It's a part of my life. I do check my inventory. Sometimes I'm right, sometimes I'm wrong. But I try to straighten it out. Upon awakening, I ask God to divorce me from self-pity, self-seeking, and give me intuitive thinking for the next 24 hours. And I don't pray for my own selfish ends. I pray for somebody else. I take a meeting into the recovery house in Central Florida, and I sponsor a lot of those guys in the early part of their recovery over there. So that's where I'm doing my 12-step stuff at. The 12 steps are not designed to take away who you are. The 12 steps are designed to take away who you're not. You know, I always knew there was a spiritual solution, but I didn't know about the program of action. My family used to clean me up and take me to church. And the preacher would preach a great sermon. And then he would do something called altar call. Mm-hmm. And I would go up to that altar and he would anoint my head. And I would stand there and say, "Man, I want what this guy got." But when I left church, I couldn't pass the ABC. Now, I'm not saying God couldn't meet me at that altar. What I'm saying is that my house wasn't in order to receive the things of God. The 12 steps say haven't had a what? Spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. Now, it ain't a problem for me to pass the ABC. You know, Michelangelo was in front of a church and he was chiseling on a big ugly stone. Little old lady came out and said, "Son, why are you chiseling on that big ugly stone?" He said, "Because on the inside of that stone there stands a beautiful angel." That's the same way the 12 steps is. When the 12 steps take away everything ugly, here's a room full of beautiful angels. Isn't that something? Man, we don't get it no better than this, right? You know, but there's a lie that centers the mind of every alcoholic, that he could one day safely drink again. And when we get away from doing the things we're supposed to do, that lie comes alive. I got a bad back, and some morning I roll out of bed on my knees, and while I'm down there, I make good use of it. I say, "God, I offer myself to thee, to build with me and do with me as thou will. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties that victory over them may bear witness to those that I may help. Of thy power, thy love, and thy will of life, may I do thy will always." What I'm asking God is, "God, get John out of the way so that I can be a maximum service to you and others." See, in order for me to drink today, I'd have to drink off a lie. I can't drink off the truth. I have to tell myself this and get good and drunk. John, you know you got an automobile, you're a homeowner, your family back in your life, and you work real hard. You deserve a beer. Now, I can have me a Budweiser off that. But if I tell myself the truth, I can't drink to save my life. If I said, "John, when you open this Budweiser, you're going to open the gates to the penitentiary. You ain't going to own a home or automobile because you're going to pawn it and sell it for drugs and alcohol. Your family's going to throw you away again. And you're going to be put deep in prison than you ever been." See, that's the truth. Because that's what happened to a guy like me when he drank alcohol. I've tried controlled drinking. It's that red, I'll try a little white. It's that white, I'll drink a little wine. The only way I can have a normal life is that I have to abandon the idea that I can safely drink. The idea that I can safely drink has got to be smashed. Listen at this. I want to tell you something funny. I want to tell you about my trike record. This is my trike record. I get out of prison. I do good for a little while. I take a drink. I use some drugs. I commit some crimes. I go to jail. I go right back to prison. I get out of prison. I do good for a little while. I take a drink. I use some drugs. I commit some crimes. I go back to jail. I go back to prison. Now, you think it's going to change this time, but it don't. I get out of prison. I do good for a little while. I take a drink. I use some drugs. I commit some crimes. I go back to jail and back to prison. That's been my life for over 20 years. So why, how could I tell myself today if I take a drink it's going to be any different? My track record keep me sober. You know what I mean? But when I made it to Alcoholic Anonymous, I thought that I was weak until I got to the big book of Alcoholic Anonymous. Bill said that most of us was unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics. And then he told us how we had to get this thing. He said we must conceive in our innermost selves that we are alcoholics. And then he assured us that we can't drink again. He said we're like men that have lost their legs. Once losing their legs, they don't grow new ones. Once losing the ability to control my drinking, I don't regain it. Once I found out I had alcoholism, then you all could help me. You told me that I had to admit that I was powerless over alcohol and my life was unmanageable. You told me I had to come to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. You told me that my own conception of God was enough and that the realm of the spirit was broad and roomy. You told me I had to make a decision to turn my life and my will over to the care of God as I understood him. You told me my will was everything I wanted and my life was everything I possessed. If everything I wanted and everything I possessed was causing me a lot of problems, to turn it over to God shouldn't be a big deal. You told me that I had to learn to live along spiritual lines, or I was going to die an alcoholic death, and that my troubles were of my own making, and I had to quit playing God, and that God was to be my new director, that he's the principal and we're the agents. He's the father, and we're his children. You told me that that concept was the keystone to the new and triumph arch from which I could pass through to freedom. Then you made me a promise. You told me if I would stay close to God and perform his work well, that God would take care of me. See, I'm at a place in my recovery where either God is or he ain't. He's everything or he's nothing. God's everything in my life. I walk by faith and not by sight. I'd rather walk alone with God in the dark than any man in the light. See, I've had some of the best sponsorship and mentors that a man could have in his life. The men that sponsored me and mentored me, they're not men that just talk the big book of Alcoholic Anonymous. They're men that live the big book of Alcoholic Anonymous. One of my mentors told me once that, God, you got to treat God like any good mother that would play hide and go seek with her child. See, a good mother that play hide and go seek with her child, she's going to hide where that child could find her. And when that child find that mother, she love all over it. See, I got news for you. God is not lost. God could and would if he was sought. And he told me that I was to always treat God like a gentleman. See, a gentleman won't come in up to a place unless you invite him. So every morning I ask God into my day. And a gentleman won't stay if you don't treat him good. So all day long I'm about my father's business. See, when I came into these rooms, I bought my worst, and you gave me your best. And when I would mess up, y'all told me to keep coming back. Everywhere else I went told me not to come back. And if I showed up to an event, they said, who told him? But you know, y'all helped me to remember my mother in a special way. You took the 12 steps of Alcoholic Anonymous, and you done for me what my mother was trying to do for me. And today I live by the golden rule. I'm not selfish, dishonest. I'm not dishonest or selfish when it comes down to my friends. And I love the Central Group, and I love you guys. And thanks for having me. Yeah. Hold up. Somebody want a woodpecker story? One time I'm down in my family house, and sometimes my family look at me and they watch me, and I turn and I catch them and I say, well, why are you watching me like that? They say, it ain't nothing. I said, come on, tell me, why are you watching me like that? And they say, well, how did you do it? And I tell them I'm just like the old woodpecker. And they say, how is the woodpecker? That was the woodpecker that got up religiously every morning and went and pecked on a hardwood tree to get the worms and mites out. One morning the woodpecker got up and went to peck on the tree, and a dark cloud formed over the tree. And a streak of lightning came out the cloud and it split the tree. And the old woodpecker was able to eat all the worms and mites that he wanted to. And then here come a whole flock of woodpeckers. and they joined him and they began to eat with him. And one of the woodpeckers looked up at him and said, "Well, how did you do it?" He said, "I showed up and did what I was supposed to do, and God did the rest." That's my story.